Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
are an empty tree that you never want your mother to meet. And finally, I found somebody who fit perfectly. You're everything that I dreamed you'd be. And now be what you need, cause I'm playing for keeps, baby.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Blog Talk Radio Show for the National Coalition of Women of Color in Construction. And our topic for today is the Accelerating the Growth of Women of Color in Construction and Contracting. You're with your host, Karima Ali. Today is October 29th, 2008. And we are in the city of Stone Mountain, Georgia. Our main topic is the four major components necessary to start and grow businesses, and why it takes a sudden blow to your business to identify whether or not you need these requirements in order to be a part of a particular industry. And we take those very lightly, and those things that we take lightly are the human capital and social capital environments. I'd like to also mention today that we have a very, very enormous topic when it comes to social capital networks. We have a caller on. Caller from 770962.
Yep, that's Nicole with Giovanna. Hey, Karima.
Hey, Nicole. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good. Very good. We were talking about the, and you know better than anyone about the networking that it takes in order to sustain a business. I guess you are one of the very key individuals that I know that has started and become very successful based on just generally networking and creating both your human capital networks and your social capital networks. So therefore, you're able to have a more sustainable type of business, and it also gives you an opportunity to have a more financial comfortable business as well when you have a base of people and resources to help you.
Exactly.
And I think when we first met, we talked about, I guess, candidly, the general contractor's license last year, and we said, well, this is not something that's going to affect me. And as we both have witnessed here in the Atlanta, Georgia area, it's affected not you together, but wholeheartedly, it will affect all of us. And so we jokingly talked about that, and we talked about, the lady that you met when you first got started, that she didn't want to share any information about the type of business that you wanted to get into, because she asked, why should she help you?
Mm-hmm.
And jokingly enough, she probably should have answered you, because I think you're one of her better competitors as well. Could you kind of enlighten some of the other callers on that, what some of your tactics was in terms of the networks that you came from based on, from CEFG, you created a base there, you created things with the city of Atlanta, you went and met with contractors, things of that nature. Do you mind sharing that?
Sure, no problem. I think the people that turned me down, and the initial, actually was two ladies that I initially met when I was just at the beginning stage of almost 4 years ago. Actually, what they did and said motivated me to push even harder, to be honest with you. And what I did from there, I went to people who would talk to me and who would sit down and tell me what it took to be a viable business. And from there, did what they recommended, going to pre-bid meetings, going to any expos, any conference, conference seminars, just out there and getting your name out there, letting people see your face, even if you have to show up at the plan holders room every day for them to see your face. And I think that was that's a big part of it, for you to go to, you know, as many pre-bid meetings as you can, meet as many people who, not only the people who can give you a contract, but the people who work with the prime contractors and know what it takes, you know, what they're looking for from their contractors. So networking is definitely important, because knowledge is money. I mean, knowledge is really everything. It may not, you may not see the immediate results from networking and from talking to people, but down the road, you will see how that will pay off for you.
Okay, and this is one of the subjects that that came aboard, was the, interesting enough, there was something in an article in November 16, 2007. It's No World Borders Human Capital Network. It revitalizes the workforce in the workplace. And interestingly enough, it says innovative web-based systems identifies networks of human capital around the world more quickly and economically for efficient workplace management. And so, therefore, they're able to, based on human capital and the networks that they have, they can quickly recruit and assign projects around the globe based on the individualized skills of individuals. And when you were networking with these folks at the different venues, when you brought your presentation to them, was it based on who you were as a business owner, or was it based on the fact that you had a better motivational drive to you know, talk to these contractors based on what the woman motivated you to do? You saw that when you started networking, your revenue started to increase.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. To me, I would attribute it to just feeling comfortable with you. You know, it may be quite a few people out there who can perform a certain duty or handle a particular job, but when it comes down to it, you know, if you had two tickets to a ball game, you know, and you, who would you call? You're going to call somebody you feel more comfortable with. And I think that's part of it. You know, I approach people in a more relaxed way, not just, you know, give me a contract. Just getting to know them, letting them get to know me, letting them know, you know, what my goals are, that I can, you know, put in 150% with anything that they try to give me. I will give it my all. So I think, and also strategic alliances, too, have been very important to me.
And by mentioning strategic alliances, we have a caller in from the 330 area code. Caller from 330. Hello.
Thank you. Online Radio. I'm your host, Karima Ali, with the NCWCC Digital Online Broadcast Network. I noticed that got a few people listening in on Facebook and Twitter. I want to thank you guys for listening in. As we start to climb up out of some areas of some of our community social responsibilities over the last 14 days and working with Starbucks and the Atlanta Silverbacks and as well as the Kids and Pros, we getting back to business. Last week we unified and brought on some CEOs interviews that took place in 2008. See how complicated life is, you guys, that basically you have what I said, I told you so. One of the things I want to discuss with everybody this afternoon, as I got a few minutes left into the show, is that to some horrendous situations that are taking place in Metro Atlanta, I've had to take a step back and air in more comfortable settings. As Thursday, I want everybody to be led up to the fact that I will be interviewed by Patricia Hunt on some personal experiences that have taken place on my personal behalf and experiencing forms of not just discriminatory practices, but the reason why women owned businesses have suffered almost $90 billion worth of loss. It's a ridiculous number. The United States Women's Chamber of Commerce CEO Margot Dorfman has a screencast that she is broadcasting. You can go on to the ncwcc.org page and bring out the validity. But we're going to be talking about Scott and Sons Holdings, Fulton County, and the individuals who are tied to Scott and Sons. And this is a company that is minority-owned, African-American-owned, and has somehow figured out the way to practice how to discriminate against other people. This is their mythology. I've had people in my past seem to want to discriminate against me, but I've never really had it totally happen. We'll be talking about that on Thursday. Some of you all had received some cease and desist orders, and I'm glad they sent those out, but this company is one of the most fraudulent companies. We found out a lot of information. They've turned a lot of situations upside down to allow them to be, as they think, a successful company. And so we want to broadcast my personal experience in dealing with them and how they just perform in business and how they enact using the system itself, which is miraculously, as women of color, when we try to use the system, it doesn't work. But when the black guy, uses the system and understands that how to discriminate against any kind of person and make life hard and create hostile environments, and use the social media that we've been talking about the last two shows on how to build new relationships, these guys have been given the benefit of doubt and a pass, a card that actually allows them to just do whatever they want to, from tax fraud to bid rigging to just even campaign donations, fraudulent mortgage actually working without a payment and performance bond on projects, a whole lot of things. And, I'm the gloves came off for me personally. And so this is a disclaimer. This has nothing to do with NCWCC Digital Online or the National Coalition. This is a Karima Ali thing. I want to make sure that everybody understands that the organization and the coalition has nothing to do with my experience with these guys. And I will be putting out a how to get around discriminatory and bad behavior practices when companies that's supposed to be licensed have professional life safety issue and the quality of life of working on projects. We have sent the notices out to Fulton County government and asking and requesting them to host a meeting about the practices of this particular company. The company had no prior knowledge of working on this level until they actually met me. What I do for a living, you guys, if people don't know, is that I'm a professional project manager and estimator. I am the person who bids the work for you guys and wins. So we'll be talking about me being able to, at my skill level, 20-some years, has been able to secure over $5 million worth of work in 60 days for this company, and them get away with not paying for services and getting away with telling their clients whatever they want to tell them. You know, and the clientele is very large, and we'll be listing those, and I'm hoping that the United States Women's Chamber is listening in, Margot Dorfman. We are going to be asking, I am going to personally ask all of my people that I know personally across the country and across the world to start calling in. This is a serious situation because I'm a qualified also concrete journeyman, concrete finisher with past experience, past performance, working with Lane Construction, Turner Construction, Brasford & Gorrie, some of the major companies in the world that do commercial. And just imagine me being a victim of someone that only has 10 years in the business, and because they are politically and fraternally connected, that they have the ability to be whatever they want to. But we're going to sit back. If you do nothing, say nothing. And I guarantee you that that is not going to happen. The voices that you have been hearing on the show or something be used from 2000. And we were talking about social human capital networks. This is how companies have been successful in this recession or someplace. Some people have said, no, the recession has not had effect anymore. However, it's affected certain ones who have not been able to master that. And so with that being said, what I want to do is just go to, in the last few minutes, a pre-recorded interview from Roberta Hunt out of Portland, Oregon, talking about her dissertation.
This is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. I'm here talking with Roberta Hunt, who's an adjunct professor at Portland State University and a PhD candidate. A thesis called Don't Mess With My Money.
Black tradeswomen negotiating intersections of race and gender in the U.S. building trades.
So Roberta has done a mess of interviews with black women, and being a black woman herself, she has a particular perspective, and her thesis is not only dealing with the institutional barriers and opportunities that black women face in the trades, but also the personal survival strategies. So talk to us about what you've been doing.
I interviewed 15 black tradeswomen who've been in the industry for 6 to 30 years.
Is this mostly in the Portland area or?
Around the U.S., so in the Pacific Northwest, in the South, in the Northeast, and in the Southwest.
And so what did you find out about institutional barriers? Let's talk about that first.
Well, the institutional barriers that they have to negotiate are around getting trained, continuing to work, getting promoted, and the impact of racism and sexism on all of those things. And also dealing with interpersonal, you know, racism and sexism from coworkers, not wanting to work with them or hindering their progress. And the toll that that takes, right? The toll that that takes on self-esteem, on physical health, on passion about your work, right? And so having to kind of negotiate that and still keep themselves in the game, still keep themselves earning, still keep themselves feeling good about what they do and about the contribution that they make, even when that contribution is not always respected by their peers.
So can you give us a story or two that helps illustrate the kind of barriers you're talking about?
Sure. You know, I think about one person that I interviewed. She's very unique. Her mother started her own concrete business, and this was in the Midwest. She started her own concrete business, and then she got her two daughters to enter the union, the concrete union, and the cement mason union, and become cement masons. And this was in the 80s, so it was a very very rare, right, to have women and have black women in the cement mason union. And she ended up suing the union twice for discrimination. And she still, even though she was suing them, she still got her journey card. and she would work for her mom's business and for the union, and that was her, and that was really her way of journeying out, because finding white males, finding that were willing to work with her as a black woman apprentice was really, really hard. So she ended up, you know, going to the South, and there were big, big projects happening in the South in the early 90s. And, you know, we have the Olympics and all of this. And there were calls for, come work on the Olympics. And she never worked, right? She never worked on the Olympics. And here she was, a journeyed cement mason who was told that she wasn't from Atlanta, therefore she didn't need to, she couldn't work for them. And in that union, there were about three women in that union. And her ability to stay in the industry has really been her amazing business savvy and her becoming a contractor. She says the woman who owns the contract rules the world. And so just her longevity and being able to stay in even when, and to network. Like, she's done amazing networking with tradeswomen organizations, with a lot of tradeswomen organizations have really been important for her. And in creating her own, she created the National Association of Women of Color in Construction. And her name is Karima Ali. And I use her name because I she was one of the people in my study who really wanted her name to be used. And because for many women to talk about this stuff, you know, you run further risk of being ostracized. And so the fact that Karima is in a position to say her name is a really important piece. And it's very rare.
So can you talk about some stories from the Portland area? And particularly since a lot of our listeners are union members and members of the union construction trades, what kind of experiences black women have had with the unions in the Portland area?
Well, for confidentiality, I can't talk about the Portland.
Oh, you can't talk about the Portland. Even when you don't use names. Don't use names. Oh, that's fine. No, you don't want to talk about specific unions. But
yeah. There are so few, right, black tradeswomen in Portland, right? I mean, they are a happy handful. And I think that is indicative of a lot, too.
Well, let's talk in generalities then, because I know in talking to my sister, Donna Hammond, who's with the Electrical Workers Union and high profile, very using all kinds of strategies to survive in that environment, she's expressed the great disappointment that in the 70s, when affirmative action was really rolling in the trades, there were many more black people coming in than there are today.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the lack of institutional support and commitment to diversifying the workforce shows, right? Where institutions have said, we want a diverse body of folks coming in, they have a diverse body of folks. Where they have said we want it and then have done things to actually keep people out. So that kind of two-sided speech, right, where on one side you're saying it's okay and on the other side what you're saying is we don't want this.
Well, how would you describe the way that they keep people out?
So, you know, we think about, like, so there was an influx of women and of people of color in the trades in the 70s and 80s. And we pay attention that now the numbers are actually less than the numbers at that time. And one of the, you know, some of the things that have contributed to that have been when women and women of color would come into the trades, they would deal with or still do with sexist slurs, with racial slurs. You know, and for many of the women that I interviewed, dealing with those, it hurts, it doesn't feel good, but that's not, you know, that's not the thing that, like, gets people out. But what gets people out is not being given work, right? And, you know, going to the union hall, getting trained, having the union say, yeah, we want more people of color, we want more people of color. And then when people are out of work, the women of color, you see a concentration of women of color sitting on the sidelines, right? And so you know, all these resources go into helping get women in, helping get women of color in, and yet the women of color who've gotten in, there's not a continuing of their careers. It's kind of like a sink or swim.
And a lot of the getting work is because of personal networks. Even though there's hiring halls, people get work by going out to work sites, right? And knowing people and having relatives.
Right. You know, and it's one of those things of, and you know, you often hear from employers, they'll say, well, you know, it's not that I don't want to hire, like I've heard this from contractors, it's not that I don't want to hire people of color. I mean, I'm really fine with that. I'm fine with people of color. I just hire who I know, right? And what that does is it's a colorblind analysis that continues to disenfranchise people of color, right? And it's not about whether or not someone is good. It's about who you know. And even though within the union system, you know, we have the lists and all of this thing, you can get around the list. People get around the lists all the time. And what that means is that people of color and women, if they're not tight, the people in the hiring hall or the people on the job site, that they get left behind. What I often think of is if you want to know how well your union is doing in terms of retaining women and people of color, pay attention to who's leaving. Right? Who's leaving your union? How often are they working? What's happening on their, with their apprentices, what's happening on their reports? I mean, I found it interesting listening to a carpenter apprentice who received a scathing report on her apprentice evaluation. And she received a scathing report from a supervisor who had never worked with her. And said that she was not doing her job, that she was, you know, lazy. And she fought back against that. And she said, how can you say I'm no good when you have me working in the under the bridge instead of on top of the bridge alongside journey people? You have me loading materials. And when you do give me the opportunity to work alongside a journey person, you're upset that I don't know what to do when you haven't been allowing me to develop. She ended up.
Right. That is Roberta Hunt. I want everyone to understand the similarities and the polarities that happen within the context of this interview. This interview also is particularly, I appreciate it from Roberta, with the fact that it allows us the opportunity to know that within this time frame, years into this particular discriminatory practices and all this is actually sprinkled upward to the contractors. The same practices internalized. Infrastructure, it's built in the infrastructure of every contracting officer's. It's built in the government. It's built internally. So when you have the United States Women Chamber stating that the largest loss of revenue and of contracts was lost of $90 billion, please believe that. This is what we'll be talking about. We're going to be coming forward about Scott & Sons Holding. We're going to actually implicate all the people based on my personal knowledge. And, again, I disclaim this. That the NCWCC, the Digital Online, and all of its subsidiaries has anything to do with this. This system has to be brought out. I don't care how many CSPSIS numbers I can talk to you about how they manipulated the FBI, how they manipulated the county contract. All these things we'll be talking about on Thursday. So you guys tune in. I'm your host, Kareem Al.